Mr. Foley, how are you?
Mrs. Holland, good afternoon, members of the panel. If I could take this opportunity, it's my pleasure to introduce Billy Nullis, who will be arguing on behalf of Mr. Jackson. Mr. Nullis is with the Federal Defender's Office in Philadelphia, and he's a member of four different bars, including Pennsylvania, New York, District of Columbia, and Florida. And without further ado, I hand the podium over to Mr. Nullis. Thank you.
Nullis, welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court.
Let me tell you about our clock system before we start. You have a total of 20 minutes, and you'll have a green light until we get down to the time you've reserved, and then it'll be yellow, and you can continue, but you will be using your reserved time.
Your Honor, thank you. And may it please the court, as Mr. Foley indicated, my name is Billy Nullis, and I'm appearing with Mr. Foley on behalf of Mr. Jackson this morning. What I would like to do, given the court's time limitations, is I think what would be most fruitful to your honors would be to outline the five bases upon which we have submitted relief is required in Mr. Jackson's case. Three of those bases are underscored by the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution, and two of them involve due process concerns. Due process concerns, one of the bases was discussed by this court in the Stevenson decision, and the other one is the Gardner versus Florida decision from the United States Supreme Court. Before I do that, however, if the court will allow, I'd just like to take a moment just to review what happened between Mr. Hurley and Judge Bifferato at the time that Mr. Jackson was originally prosecuted. And the reason I do that is not in any way to suggest that your honors are not familiar with the brief or the record, but just Mr. Foley and I have found that whenever we review it, the constitutional errors leap out of the record, and they give content to the five bases that I'll address in a moment. Specifically, Mr. Jackson was a brain-damaged 18-year-old at the time that he was charged with capital murder. He had a history of abuse. He had mental health issues. He was a disturbed young man from the perspective that he had brain damage, and he was young. He's represented by Joseph Hurley. Joseph Hurley, as he said to Judge Bifferato, had been in practice for 17 years at the time that he approached Judge Bifferato in November. The court knows Mr. Hurley. Mr. Hurley is an experienced criminal defense lawyer. And he said to Judge Bifferato, who he knew would be responsible for capital sentencing in this case, that in his 17 years of practice, he's always been able to divorce himself emotionally from the case, with one exception, Mr. Jackson's case. He said that Mr. Jackson gave him an absolute sense of revulsion. He said that it was an emotional strain to even have to meet with his client. He said that when he met with Mr. Jackson, he found him distasteful, and it was an emotional strain for him. He said to Judge Bifferato, who would preside at sentencing, that Mr. Jackson, quote, ought to die, ought to be executed. He said this twice in that presentation. He said that Mr. Jackson was guilty, and he said that his representations about Mr. Jackson arose based on what he characterized as a private conversation with him about the case. Quote, the explanations that were given created emotional responses in me. Mr. Foley and I have reviewed all of this court's capital and many of this court's criminal decisions. We don't think this court has ever confronted a situation such as this. And as your honors know from the briefs, both the initial and the reply briefs, we've tried to collect cases from various courts that have involved a violation of the duty of loyalty, such as this, or even in the ballpark from defense counsel. Invariably, every one of those courts have granted relief, and the state has not been able to cite to this court any case where there's a violation of the duty of loyalty that comes even close to Mr. Jackson's case, where relief has been denied. Just to put it in context, if the comments that Mr. Hurley made to Judge Bifferato were made by members of the family of the decedent to Judge Bifferato, this court, as it did in Ortiz and as the United States Supreme Court indicated in Payne, would reverse because of the fundamental nature of that error. Here, those comments came from defense counsel, an experienced member of the bar, somebody who had 17 years' experience, who violated the duty of loyalty in a very, very atrocious manner. That proceeding was then not disclosed Neither Mr. Jackson nor any of the subsequent counsel knew about it. When the transcript was prepared at the time of the direct appeal, Judge Biferato ordered that the transcript be sealed. So this court did not know about it at the time of the direct appeal or at the time of the prior post-conviction appeal in Mr. Jackson's case.
Well, does the record reflect that when the first appeal was taken, the attorneys for Mr. Jackson were aware of the fact that there was something in existence under seal?
They would have been aware potentially of something in existence, but Judge Cooch specifically found that the matter was not disclosed, that it was withheld from all prior counsel in the case, and that it was only fortuitously something that came up at this point. That's a finding of fact that comes to this court presumed correct and that the state has not contested. Judge Cooch also found that this scenario, regardless of procedural issues, constitutes a miscarriage of justice. At least he found that a colorable showing of miscarriage of justice is raised. And with that introduction, if I may, let me go through the five bases, because if I do nothing else today, I at least want myself and Mr. Foley to be assured that we've gotten these bases to the court. And the first, under the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, is a violation of the duty of loyalty. There is no question that this was a violation of the duty of loyalty that a defense counsel owes to the client. As the Tenth Circuit indicated in the Osborne case, which among others we've described in the initial and the reply briefs, an attorney who abandons his duty of loyalty to his client suffers from an obvious conflict of interest. And the abrogation of the duty of loyalty in this case is direct on the part of Mr. Hurley. The duty of loyalty is the core of what Strickland versus Washington talks about. It's the core of the Sixth Amendment protection. All of the other duties of counsel that we think about, to research and to be prepared, to conduct a thorough investigation, to test the government's case and provide a reasonable adversarial testing, all of those duties are fundamentally...
Well, Judge Cooch went on to say that even though there was a miscarriage of justice, whether you characterize it as a violation of the duty of loyalty or not, there was no reversible error here. There was no harm that requires reversal.
Judge Cooch actually found a remarkable display of disloyalty. And the reason I start with the duty of loyalty is because a violation of the duty of loyalty is presumptively prejudicial. Prejudice is presumed when the duty of loyalty is violated.
Conclusively or only by way of a rebuttable presumption?
There is a presumption of prejudice that the state would have to rebut. Now, the typical way the state would rebut it, for example, would be to show that the sentence imposed was life, or that the matter was disclosed and another judge presided. Those would be the classic manners of rebuttal. There is no way to rebut, however, the presumption of prejudice arising from the duty of loyalty in this case.
Are you relying on the United States Supreme Court decision in Chronic for this or something?
Chronic is the second decision, Your Honor, that I'll talk about in a moment. But this comes directly from Strickland itself. Strickland itself says the duty of loyalty is fundamental. And if you take a look, for example, in the reply brief at the Kidwell case that we cited from the Military Court of Appeals, or the cases from the Connecticut Supreme Court, or the Utah Supreme Court, or Osborne, the Tenth Circuit case, or Blanco, the Eleventh Circuit case, all of those take as a given that when the duty of loyalty is violated, that is something that is inherently prejudicial. And it is especially prejudicial.
That may make sense in a case where Hurley makes that disclosure and then continues to represent his client. But that's not what happened here. He was allowed to withdraw. Substitute counsel was appointed. Substitute counsel withdrew later. Another substitute counsel was appointed. Case went on to trial. Now, I think the state would argue that that, combined with other intervening events, rebutted whatever presumptive prejudice occurred, if any there was. What is your response?
And that goes to what I was going to talk about in sort of a traditional Strickland sense of deficient representation and classic prejudice, which you also have in this case. And to put it in context, this court in Stevenson talked about the unique role of the capital sentencing judge in Delaware. In Caldwell versus Mississippi, the Supreme Court talked about that role as something that is highly subjective, personalized, and making a specific moral decision about that defendant and whether death is appropriate. And that to initiate a prejudice calculus in that kind of situation, when there is error that goes directly to the penalty.
Well, counsel, you're talking doctrine, and I'm asking you a question of fact.
Yes, sir.
Or at least to identify factually what is the prejudice in these circumstances where all of these intervening events took place. Then talk about the doctrine.
Yes, sir. And I was doing the doctrine to put the prejudice in context. And the prejudice in context, if you look at it through the lens of requiring a showing of prejudice, is that this court cannot confidently conclude that that sentencing decision was not tainted.
Right, so we've gone from the disloyalty of Mr. Hurley to its effect on the judge. And your answer to the intervening circumstances are that the judge remained the same and it was the judge who was affected. So tell us the authority that you're – I know you cited Stevenson, but what other authority are you relying on for the proposition that the effect on the judge requires reversal?
Yes, Your Honor. The effect on the judge was discussed by this court in Stevenson itself very thoroughly. You also have what I was going to describe as the last of the five sort of categories, the second due process category, which is Gardner versus Florida. Neither the state nor Judge Cooch have addressed the Gardner argument that we've raised in Mr. Jackson's case from the very outset. And the Gardner argument is significant because Gardner holds that when there is improper information that could potentially have an effect on the sentence, that is constitutional error. In Gardner itself, the court did not engage in a harmless error analysis, did not look for prejudice. In fact, there's a footnote in Gardner where the state attempted to submit the pre-sentence investigation report that was at issue in Gardner to say, it's no big deal. There was nothing that was such a big deal in it. And the Supreme Court said, that's not admissible at this juncture. What we look at is information that could have potentially impacted on the sentence, given the heightened scrutiny required in a capital case, the same language that this court used in Stevenson, given the unique role of the sentencing judge, who has a role that if there's harm, there's no way to really gauge the impact. Given that, when information goes to the sentencing judge that the defendant has no opportunity to rebut or explain, and, Your Honor, the subsequent counsel never had an opportunity to rebut or explain what Mr. Hurley planted in Judge Biferato's thinking. And when there's no opportunity for the defendant or counsel to rebut or explain the potentially harmful information, under Gardner, that's constitutional error. And the state has not addressed the Gardner argument, and neither did Judge Cooch. Neither has the state or Judge Cooch actually grappled with what is now I'm going backwards, with the second due process analysis, which arises from this court's decision in Stevenson. In Stevenson, this court explained that the risk, and this court used the word risk three times in Stevenson, the risk of error is particularly acute in a capital case where the ultimate fixing of the sentence is in the hands of the judge, given the judge's unique role. And this court specifically held that when information gets to the judge that the judge should not have and that is harmful to the defendant, no specific showing of prejudice need be shown under this court's due process analysis. Just to get back to Your Honor's question, even if we were looking at it as a Strickland versus Washington, what is the prejudice, which we don't think we need to get to because this is presumptively prejudicial, you can see here that there's an effect on Judge Biferato. In Judge Biferato's sentencing opinion at page 10, Judge Biferato called this crime cold, depraved, and indifferent. He called Mr. Jackson as a person who was indifferent to human life. At page 13, he described Mr. Jackson as having an utter disregard of human life. At page 13, again, Mr. Jackson, no regard for the property or health of others. And at page 14, he described that Mr. Jackson, according to Judge Biferato, had a character that is void of any concern for human life or property of others. What is also significant, that mirrors sort of the loathsome description of Mr. Jackson that Judge Biferato had gotten from Mr. Hurley.
But the prejudice that you're claiming and relying on is the influence that the disclosure by Mr. Hurley had on the sentencing judge at the sentencing stage. Is that correct?
The prejudice is the risk of unconstitutionality, that it affected the sentencer's decision because of the disclosure from Mr. Hurley and because no other attorney had a chance to address it or to fix it.
Right. But the stage that we're talking about is the sentencing stage.
The prejudice going to the sentencing stage in that regard. The second prejudicial area under Stevenson is that since Judge Biferato presided in the first Rule 61 proceeding, we have argued that Mr. Jackson should be given an opportunity to pursue a Rule 61 proceeding before a judge who had not been tainted in this way. And that's the relief that you granted in Stevenson. Let me go back before I start eating up my rebuttal time to that sentencing order, however. There was the mitigating evidence that I described originally. There was also evidence from Mr. Jackson's family and friends that he was loving, compassionate, sensitive, warm, that he was a good person. That is not even discussed in Judge Biferato's order. And although in Stevenson, this court, and in Gardner, the Supreme Court, and in the various other cases that we cited, the courts have said, you don't try to do a fine calculus. You don't try to like, okay, where can I pinpoint prejudice as to in a sentencing phase? The fact that the evidence about Mr. Jackson's being compassionate doesn't appear anywhere, is not even discussed in the sentencing order, whereas the order characterizes Mr. Jackson in a way that mirrors what Mr. Hurley said, describes him as depraved, gives him that loathsome description, shows that even psychologically there would have been some effect on Judge Biferato. And psychologically is the word that this court used in Stevenson. And so as a matter of due process, there's error here. So we have violation of the duty of loyalty. We have a classic Strickland versus Washington situation of deficient performance and demonstrable prejudice, at least sufficient to undermine this court's confidence in this death sentence, or as this court said in Stevenson, to undermine public confidence in the death sentence. And the final area, other than the two due process areas out of Stevenson and Gardner, is a breakdown in the adversarial process. And that one arises when a lawyer takes positions that are diametrically opposite to their client's interest. That is the chronic type of error. That's a breakdown, a total breakdown in the adversary process. There's two kinds of those. There's when counsel doesn't think they're counsel, and therefore they don't act as lawyers. The other one that the case law has clearly articulated, and we've quoted all of the cases in the briefs, is when counsel takes a position.
You can certainly continue, but you're down to 3 minutes.
I can see that, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so based on those five bases, we would respectfully submit that certainly a resentencing is appropriate. And given the new evidence that has come to light, and given that Judge Biferato presided in the first Rule 61 proceeding, we respectfully submit also that a new Rule 61 proceeding, unencumbered by successive petition procedural bars, is appropriate for Mr. Jackson. And, Your Honor, that's where the prejudice goes in this case. I thank Your Honors very much for the Court's consideration.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Ms. McFarland.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May it please the Court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the State. In affirming Jackson's, the denial of Jackson's first post-conviction motion, this Court found that the evidence against Jackson was overwhelming and the trial resulted in a verdict worthy of confidence. Now, after many stages of litigation, Jackson is left with an attack on the trial judge, the Honorable Vincent A. Biferato. Mr. Hurley made comments to Judge Biferato at a hearing on his motion to withdraw. He had made it clear earlier, Mr. Hurley had, that he wanted to withdraw if the evidence came out badly in terms of the defense, and indicated that he felt it would be burdensome for the family if he continued his representation. His initial discussion about that with the judge indicated he was not particularly supportive of that decision and encouraged Mr. Hurley to stay, which then resulted in, later when the motion was filed, this hearing. Mr. Hurley informed the court that he wanted to say things that would be prejudicial to his client. And Judge Biferato was very reluctant to have a sidebar. He particularly wanted to do this in open court, mindful that it was a first-degree murder case. Excuse me. And only went to sidebar when the attorney insisted, and with Mr. Jackson's approval and permission to do that. Although, obviously, Mr. Jackson did not know what Mr. Hurley was going to say, he knew that what Mr. Hurley was going to say would be prejudicial to be said in open court about him.
All right. So we understand that Judge Biferato may have been broadsided by this comment. It was certainly not something that he invited, but he found himself in a situation that wasn't of his own making. The argument, however, is that, be that as it may, that those comments fatally affected the trial judge's mindset, with the result that it may have pushed the trial judge over the line in terms of deciding whether or not to impose a sentence of life or death. Now, and as evidence of that, opposing counsel has cited certain snippets from the from Judge Biferato's penalty opinion. Now, it may well be that you know that what influenced the way that opinion was written was the evidence at the at both trials. It could be that what influenced them was the jury's recommendation, and it could be that Mr. Hurley's comments might played some role. Unfortunately, we won't know what role, if any, Mr. Hurley's comments played, because this is not a laboratory in which we can do controlled experimentation changing different variables. The argument, as I understand it, and that I would hope you can respond to, is that since there's presumptive prejudice, then we can't eliminate the possibility that Mr. Hurley's comments improperly influenced the sentencing decision, that undermines confidence in the death sentence that was ordered here.
Yeah, thank you, Justice Jacobs. First, the state would not agree that there's presumptive prejudice here. That's the first place. Second, under the sort of idea that if a judge hears something prejudicial, that will presumptively affect their sentencing, that's an untenable rule. Judges are gatekeepers. They hear information about defendants on a regular basis that is inadmissible, that is often very prejudicial. They hear confessions that are not let in. They hear attorneys inform them about their belief that their client is about to perjure themselves. These are all things that we expect judges to be able to hear and put aside. In fact, in this case, there wasn't even any evidence presented to the judge. There was no fact. This was Mr. Hurley's emotional response, and it was an opinion of an attorney who was immediately removed 4 months before trial.
Well, tell us how things should work in the next case. Here, after the comments were made, that portion of the record was sealed. You know, what's the purpose in sealing the record, and should it have been unsealed later? I read the arguments, it is, first, the judge should have sua sponte said, well, having heard that, I'm going to recuse myself, or alternatively said, I'm going to put this under seal and grant your motion. And then I'll disclose what you've said to the next attorney for Mr. Jackson, and if they want to make a motion for me to recuse myself, I'll rule on that at the time. Neither of those alternatives, were pursued. And now we have the situation where the argument is if we had known that had transpired, there would have been a motion. Putting all that aside, what should a trial judge do if this situation comes up again?
Well, respectfully, Justice Holland, there was another attorney at that sidebar who heard those comments, who was acting on behalf of Mr. Jackson. Although she was not officially his counsel at that point. She had been meeting with him as counsel and actively represented him at that motion. She was present at the sidebar and heard the comments. The judge had no reason to believe that she, who also had the file, would not be revealing that information and turning that information over to the next attorney.
But you say that, but what was the implication once it was sealed? You know, if she's standing there, she hears the exchange, and the judge seals it. Normally, if you file a motion that's not sealed based on information that is sealed, you're in big trouble as an attorney.
That would be correct. However, that didn't preclude her from informing successor counsel as to what transpired and give that attorney an opportunity to move to unseal. At that point, it had not been transcribed. It was not transcribed and docketed as sealed until the general transcription of the trial.
Right. So your answer in this case is it could have all been taken care of. And my question is, what do we do in future cases to make sure that this all gets handled properly if someone's not at the sidebar other than the one attorney?
Okay. I think that definitely the successor counsel should be informed. There's no question.
By the trial judge.
By the judge or whoever counsel is representing. But, yes, definitely successor counsel should be made aware. There's no reason to believe in this particular case that the judge thought that counsel didn't know about it, simply because the presence of this other attorney there at the time.
So the argument, I guess, the state makes is in the alternative. It was either waived because it wasn't pursued, or it wasn't an error at all because it became known to the judge in the course of proceedings. And we have a long Weber, Lose, and other cases that say prejudicial information to a tribunal during the course of proceedings are not a basis for disqualification.
That's correct. And this claim, I mean, it was docketed and was available prior to the opening brief being filed on direct appeal. There was a docket entry, number 85, that indicates that there was a sealed document, and that was available to the parties to discover what was in it.
Well, Ms. McFarland, Mr. Nolan's argument, as I understand it, is that until the defendant was sentenced, did the defendant or any of his substitute attorneys learn about this comment, and therefore the defendant had no opportunity to rebut it and to counter whatever misimpression, if any, may have been created by those comments in the mind of the sentencing judge. That's the argument, and the conclusion that we're asked to draw from the argument is, in those circumstances, we cannot have confidence that in the death sentence. It's not a sentence in which the court can have confidence, and therefore it has to be overturned.
Well, Your Honor, this case is different, for example, than Stevenson, where the court found that it was a close case. This case, this court has repeatedly found that there was overwhelming evidence, and the trial judge heard all that evidence at trial, and this comment by Mr. Hurley was made 4 months before trial. Given the amount of evidence, the jury recommendation of 11 to 1, there really is no appearance or reason to doubt the experienced sentencing decision by a judge of Superior Court. He was a resident judge. He had been seen a lot, been there. He was not new. He was not easily influenced.
Well, is the bottom line of what you just told us that all of that overwhelming evidence would, on its own accord, have countered whatever mistaken impression that the sentencing judge had, or that even if the judge had a mistaken impression, there was an independent basis for him to order the death sentence?
Yes, that would be correct, Your Honor.
Which one?
First of all, we don't believe that he was unduly influenced. Second of all, there was overwhelming evidence, and that certainly would have been much more closely in his mind than a comment made 4 months before trial that was not based on any evidence. It was an emotional response about his wife and security and the situation. Mr. Hurley did not say anything about what Mr. Jackson did or did not do. He was talking about the situation that triggered a response. And that was the problem there. Moreover, that this secret information Gardner argument was not addressed because of the way that the claim was originally presented was as a duty of loyalty breach, which the state argued would be a claim under Strickland, and then the prejudice prong under Strickland would have succeeded had a motion to recuse on a motion to recuse, and the state argued that no, that would not have been successful, thus no prejudice under Strickland. And in light of the fact that there was a docket entry, I realized that the document itself in the file was mislabeled, but any conscientious attorney later on would have at least looked to find out what that was. Apparently no one did until 2006. But the judge was not aware of secret information in terms of making his sentencing decision. This was not a factual basis. There was no research. There was no written report. There was simply a comment made 4 months before trial by an attorney who was left.
Well, why is this any different, at least conceptually, from a witness who testifies during the penalty hearing about what a despicable, horrible human being the defendant is? Based upon his contact with the defendant, based upon what he's gotten to know about him, which is essentially what Mr. Hurley said, that this is based upon having spoken to him and having reviewed the facts and listening to him and thinking about what he did. He's a despicable, horrible human being. Well, if somebody got on the witness stand during the penalty phase and presented that view of the defendant, certainly there would be an opportunity for defense counsel to attempt to reduce the impact of those comments by showing that there was, some animus or some other reason why the person had that reaction, right?
That's correct. And they did, in fact, put on witnesses to show what a nice person Mr. Jackson was.
But the point being that here's one witness's, one potentially very important witness, because here's an attorney who's got the respect of the court, who's explained that he's done this for 17 years and he's never felt as horrible as he did in this case. So we've got one arguably important witness who, instead of getting on the witness stand during the penalty phase, is making a comment to the judge directly, and that comment gets sealed up. Isn't that a real problem?
Well, first of all, it was simply an opinion without any basis, which was not explored at all. It was short. It was 4 months before trial, and it was in the context of Mr. Hurley trying to get out of his representation, where it would not be extremely unusual for Mr. Hurley to perhaps exaggerate his point in an attempt to get out, to have his motion granted, when he was aware that the judge had not looked kindly on that motion in the first instance. The fact that it was sealed was, the best guess from the state is that the judge was trying to keep this information from prejudicing future litigation, and by having it be public. That was not an unreasonable decision on his part, especially given that he had another attorney present that he was believed involved in the representation. There's really nothing else that the defense could have put on had a witness like that been in the penalty phase, other than what they did put on, character witnesses.
But they would get a chance to cross-examine that witness, right?
Yes.
And they didn't have that opportunity in the penalty phase, so the judge got some direct information, even if it was just an opinion, that the defense counsel never got a chance to address.
Well, that is correct, but that opinion really went to the situation more than anything about what Mr. Jackson himself had done. He was talking about a security issue at his garage. This case was about a woman, a middle-aged woman, who was attacked at her garage where there was no security. That brings it home in a personal way, regardless of who the defendant was. And that was a problem for Mr. Hurley, that it became personal. The situation became personal. He did not reveal anything about what Mr. Jackson said to him or did not say to him. And he indicated that it was an emotional response. And as such, I believe an experienced Superior Court judge should be able to disassociate that from the case. And certainly Judge Biferrato was an experienced judge. And not only that, but when there was later on a motion to have recuse him based on the Talmud tapes, he looked at himself subjectively and said, I can rule on this case in a fair and impartial manner. And that certainly, when a judge looks at themselves in that subjective prong, they aren't looking at one event. They have to look at themselves as a whole and decide whether overall they feel they can proceed in an impartial manner. And he made that analysis, and he found he could.
Well, we understand your position as you've developed it so far. You know, in this particular case, there wasn't a hearing. Would there have been some benefit in having a hearing where the attorney who was at the sidebar with Mr. Hurley could have testified or even given an affidavit about what action she did or did not take based on what happened at the sidebar?
Well, unfortunately, that attorney is no longer with us. And I'm not sure on the timing of that, but I don't know when that would have been able to have occurred.
And we have no information from any of the successor attorneys about whether she passed that information along.
They have represented that she did not. And I'm certainly not in any position to challenge that representation. If there are no more questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, let me deal with the issue of Ms. Perillo and the public defender off the bat, and I ask you not to be, with all due respect, don't be misled by that. If you look at the very same November transcript where Mr. Hurley says, my client is guilty and he ought to die, 2 pages later, there's a discussion with Judge Biferrato concerning a recusal motion that had been filed by the public a motion to withdraw that had been filed by the public defender's office, by Ms. Perillo's office, which originally represented Mr. Jackson. That had been sent by Judge Biferrato to Judge Gebelein. And Judge Gebelein had already granted that at the time that Ms. Perillo appeared at this proceeding with Mr. Hurley, who was actual counsel. So she never met with Mr. Jackson. She was not Mr. Jackson's counsel at any point. The public defender had a conflict. And that very same transcript where Mr. Hurley makes his statements, 2 pages later, there's a discussion that Judge Gebelein has already granted prior to this the motion for the public defender to withdraw. As Judge Cooch found, there was no other counsel in this case that potentially could have protected Mr. Jackson's interest. The matter was sealed. The matter was not disclosed to anyone. And Mr. Hurley made these statements in the presence of counsel for the co-defendant, in the presence of counsel for the state, in the presence of the sentencing judge, but nobody told Mr. Jackson, and nobody told his subsequent counsel in the case. And you have an affidavit that we have filed from Kevin O'Connell, who was subsequent counsel, who indicated that he would have raised recusal based on this error. He would have raised the issue on direct appeal, and he would have raised the issue both in the trial court and then in the appellate proceedings. And to get back to the prejudice question, how could this court now reconstruct confidently what it would have done, what an appellate panel of this court would have done, had this error been presented on direct appeal, had Judge Biferrato had the matter presented to him and declined to recuse? How can this court today confidently conclude what Judge Biferrato would have done had Mr. O'Connell had the opportunity to say, you should recuse yourself because of the potential taint, because of the risk from what you heard from Mr. Hurley? You addressed that exact situation in Stevenson, and you indicated that the judge in Stevenson did not have the opportunity either subjectively to assess their own potential bias or objectively to address whether there's an appearance of impropriety, and therefore that in and of itself was a ground for relief in Stevenson, the same relief we request here, a new sentencing proceeding and an opportunity for a Rule 61 proceeding unencumbered by procedural default.
Thank you
very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. And thank you both for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and will adjourn.